Hey guys, welcome back to the Marvel Bronze Age. Oh, you didn't do anything. Season 2, Episode 3. Yeah, go ahead, man. That's fine. I see how it is.
It's got to be unpredictable, man.
Yes. Okay. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. I'm Ed.
The Bronze Age.
Wait, no. And I'm Levi.
Right. I was going to say, I'm still Ed. And, yeah, okay. You guys, Levi and I will do this thing every couple weeks, sit around, talk about a couple Marvel Bronze Age books, just chew the fat, give our impressions of the books, and we'll move on to the start of another beautiful week in southern West Virginia.
Yes, sir. We are ready. We are high atop Marvel Mountain in our newly remodeled 2.0 recording studio.
We've got the boom mics with the spit cages and the big... No, we don't have any of that.
We got the spit cages because, like, you just get adamant about certain things and, like, the spittle flies.
I can't help it. In the corner there of the mouth, mm-hmm, the white, yeah, foamy, yeah.
I had to actually have installed, you know, the bank protective, like, plastic thing around where I sit just so I could be
like
assured that
like the sneeze guard, yeah, at the buffet, yeah, bars. Right. I got you.
Only it's like 2 inches thick and it's got breathe holes in the back. It's, you know.
Oh, okay. I got you. Heavy duty.
Yeah. Yeah, you get adamant. Yeah. It's scary sometimes.
You got the major spit plating going over there. So
I do.
I got you.
I do, man. It's radioactive.
Yeah. All right, now. Our books this time, guys, I think I told you guys last episode. I'm not sure. If not, I apologize.
Yeah, pretty sure you did.
Thor, the first volume, issue 173, is up first. And then X-Men, the first volume, issue 65, which is kind of sad, but I'll explain why when we get to that book. spoilers of, I don't know, 40 years ago, roughly. 44, 45 years ago, maybe, something like that. So
again, like you said, man, I don't think that they can be spoilers.
I don't know. I can't really be spoiled, because even though if somebody tells me what happens, I still want to see or read how it happens.
Right.
So it doesn't bother me. I don't think I've really ever heard anything for a movie or TV or comic books that just took me out. I threw up my hands. I said, okay. I don't even want to see it now.
Well, no, not even want to see it. I do hate when people like tell me like the plot twist or the end of the movie.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But it's never, you know, like you, it's never been like, well, now I'm just not going to watch it.
Yeah. Boy, there are some people that are just vicious with comic books about that. They will get up and scream if they haven't read it yet, or, you know, and it's like... But again, if we talk about something, a movie or a TV show, or how long is the appropriate time to wait?
I don't know. I'm kind of inclined to go with like the copyright rule, 70 years.
Is that when it's set?
That's my guess.
I don't know. I would think like if you're talking about a TV show. When Netflix has the whole season streaming, I think all bets are off.
Well, yeah, because you can go to anyone and see.
Exactly. So I think you should be able to talk about, you know, movies. I don't know. I would think you would definitely be safe by the time that, like, the Redbox gets them or the pay-per-view is on.
Well, yeah. I mean, at the longest, a year, right? Because it's like,
oh,
if you have not
good
watched
day,
it,
yeah.
If you have not watched it in a year, if you just... I forgot about it. I never got around, yeah, to it. It's been a year, dude.
No. You could have bought it, rented it. You could have pay-per-viewed it. You could have pirated it. You could have gone to see it when it – I mean, yeah. Every method is you've passed in a year.
Not that we condone any illegal activity on the show.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
But, yes.
But it is an option.
It is. And it, yeah, but, you know, yeah, a year, it's like, so what are we doing, 40 on this one?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's no such thing as spoilers.
For 40, it's like 44, 45, isn't it? Let me look it up here real fast. 173.
It was February of what? 70? Of 70?
Of 70, yeah. February of 70. So that's 44. 4 years, yeah. 44, almost and a half.
Mm-hmm.
That is almost as long as I have been alive. I am a spoiler. Wait a minute.
Wait, I thought that was only like a quarter of what you've been alive.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Woo, coming in swinging.
Yeah, here, go ahead and break it off while you got it.
Oh, no, no.
Yeah, right. Okay.
I got to pull it out so I can
do it again. Use it again. Yeah, reusable.
Yeah.
All right, guys, Thor, issue 173. Kind of an interesting, in my mind, anyways, an interesting combination of characters here in this issue of Thor. And you see right away on the cover who you're going to be dealing with. Of course, Thor is there. You have Ulic, the he's a troll, but he goes by some moniker that I don't think he used in this book. But in the Thor book, he's like the not the king of the trolls, but the troll enforcer, was, something like that.
What was it? It was like the I don't know the mightiest troll or something like that.
Yeah, he has some sort of moniker.
Oh, mightiest of the trolls.
Okay.
Mightiest.
And in Thor, you know, fighting a troll is, you know, you would kind of expect that being Asgardian.
Mm-hmm.
But what you wouldn't expect is that Thor would come across the Circus of Crime.
Mm.
Now, he does in this issue, and he has in a couple previous issues within a year or so prior to this in his book as well. I thought that the Circus of Crime was primarily a Fantastic Four foe. And why I've always thought that is because here in a little bit from when we are here in 1970, when, or it might have been before, but I think it's after, when Reed and Sue got married, there was they had a big issue that they published of Fantastic Four for that. The Circus of Crime crashed their wedding.
Nice.
And so I always assumed, well, then they must definitely be Fantastic Four villains. I mean, if it was a big enough deal for them to crash the wedding.
Mm-hmm. I'd have shot the clown first.
Oh, now, in the early 2000s, the clown gets his own book.
Are you serious?
And it's very street-level, gritty, kind of, and it was very cool. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
No. No clown books, no.
It was good.
The clown needs to go.
the Gambino dude, or I think that's – see, I don't know. I don't remember them dropping a whole bunch of names and everything. But, like, I think the two twins, the acrobats, yeah, on the unicycles, yeah, I think they're like the Gambinos.
Oh, okay.
Is like their family name, and I always thought, wow.
Gambino, really? You did
yeah,
that?
You guys really pulling out the ethnic names with stuff like that, but in the 70s, I guess that was okay. I don't think it would fly now.
No.
But.
No, you'd have to go with Roberts.
Yeah, really, yeah.
Smith.
All right. Opening the book, we've got a scene of Dr. Don Blake, who, for you less versed in Thor, that is Thor's earthly alter ego. Kind of a complex relationship they have there, but basically from the beginning, Thor can change into Donald Blake and Donald Blake can change into Thor. The specifics and particulars you would just need to really get into the Thor book, and even then it doesn't always hang true. Writers don't always do it the same way, but that's kind of the basic premise.
I always thought that was odd, because in later years, like, it seemed that he dropped that alter ego and just was Thor whenever he, you know, came down or came back or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and actually, early in the Thor book, Thor finds out from his dad, Odin, who set up this whole thing, that Donald Blake Let me ask my co-host of a podcast here also. Donald Blake turns out to be an aspect of Thor that exists only when Thor isn't existing.
You mean planner wise or at all?
Period.
Oh.
The being is only one or the other. So anytime you're reading the comic book, if you see one of the characters, mm-hmm. the other one is not on any physical plane of existence.
Interesting.
So that's kind of interesting because a lot of times you assume that when Thor is up in Asgard doing stuff in Asgard mm-hmm. and stuff, well, Donald Blake is down here carrying on the Donald Blake existence.
Right.
But no, because Thor will be gone, and when he, for whatever reason, does come back to Earth and assumes the Donald Blake persona, he gets bitched at because he's been gone for 6 months, or all of his patients are gone because he's been gone. Or so, you find out, oh, so Donald Blake this whole time was gone.
Right.
But then, somewhere later on in the mythology, the two do exist separately. Even to the extent that the two get separated eventually and are two completely separate beings to where they can both be standing side by side.
That's got to be trippy for both of them.
Yeah, really. But, and you know, again, it'll change with the writers and how the writer wants to tackle it. But, you know, it started out so simply, the one changes into the other mm-hmm. and that one changes back. That's pretty straightforward to me.
Yeah, I mean, it is.
You know, but then you start throwing in, well, you know, you've got the different realms. You've got Asgard and Earth simultaneously. And it's right now, though, this is pretty mind-blowing because at this point in their history, Donald Blake and Thor cannot be standing side by side, which they are on the first page of this book.
Yep.
So automatically, I was like, well, what is going on?
What got me was the fact that Thor is juggling.
Yeah, it's, you know, he is having a rather jovial time here.
Yeah, he's got a big old smile on his face and he's juggling. And I'm like, you know, the doctor's like, feeling better now, Thor? And I'm like, no, he's not.
Yeah, really.
He's juggling.
So, and right, as Levi said, Thor is juggling a set of balls here, and we see on the floor is Thor's hammer just laying on the floor.
Yep.
Now, that is particularly pertinent because originally, and at this point in his history, a lot of these rules are still applying. They haven't been changed. If Thor is not in physical contact with his hammer for longer than 60 seconds, he reverts to Don Blake automatically.
So the power of the transformation is held within the hammer?
Apparently, because it's also the hammer. Well, actually, it's the cane of Dr. Blake's that we see here in a little bit
yeah.
that causes the transformation, the Thor way.
Yeah.
So although Donald Blake doesn't have to keep the cane to keep from turning into Thor. So what that tells me is that Blake is the normative state,
mm-hmm.
and Thor is the extraordinary state. And so in order to stay at that end of the spectrum, he has to keep the magical device in his grasp, and that's his hammer.
Yeah, it's sort of like a Banner-Hulk sort of relationship.
Kind of.
Banner being the normative.
Right, yeah. If all things are even,
yeah.
it's Banner. That's who you get.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know exactly which came first in the Marvel U, the Thor character or the Hulk character, but one may be playing off of the other as far as that circumstance.
Yeah.
Particularly since Stan Lee and Jack Kirby was responsible for Thor, but I don't know if he was responsible for Hulk or not. I don't remember Hulk. Speaking of which, this particular issue of Thor is a Stan Lee, Jack Kirby Thor, inked by Bill Everett and lettered by Artie Simek. Classic classic Marvel combination, Lee and Kirby. I think, and I'll refer several times to this. My wife Terry and I, we do a Marvel Thor podcast. For those of you who are listening and don't know or may be interested, whichever. And I think that the Lee Kirby run has some of our more favored stories and characters, and particularly art of the Thor that we've read, which is up into the 240s, 250s of this old volume that we're reading, and then we've read the past 2 or 3 years of the current volume also up to date. So Kirby in particular is one of our favorites as far as the artwork goes. Stan Lee gets kind of goofy sometimes, and there's been some better writers, I think, that we would both agree, but Stan Lee still did a pretty good job.
All right, so this issue.
Yes, moving on, we see Don talking to Thor, continuing to check on Thor's condition, and we find, indeed, that this is not Thor. This is dude in a costume and wig. He dissembles himself, his get-up here for the checkup that Don Blake is there for, and we eventually find that this gentleman is an act in a circus. The circus is run by a gentleman that I know as the Ringmaster. And because it's the Ringmaster, previous reading experience tells me that this is the circus of crime that we're dealing with, because Ringmaster is the leader of that particular cadre of evildoers, shall we say. It's a collection of people who all have a circus act, and their individual circus act is also tied into their supernatural or perhaps hypernatural power that they use to commit the crimes as they're touring around the country as this circus. This is their strongman, this Thor actor. Early on here, have we gotten a name? I don't think we've gotten a name yet.
It came later.
Okay. And here the Thor actor does drop the name Ringmaster, so.
Mm-hmm.
Ringmaster starts to get kind of suspicious about Donald Blake being there and perhaps finding out more than Ringmaster wants the doctor to know, so he kind of shoos the doctor. Once he finds out that his strongman, at the very least, is going to live, he kind of shoos Donald Blake on out. And Blake leaves, seems to be going on his merry way, but down the road there somewhere he pulls off, aware from previous experience that this is the circus of crime. Don Blake does the single cane tap on the ground, which initiates the transformation into Thor.
And see, I'm not very familiar with Thor, so this was new for me. I was like, what the heck is he doing? Why does he have a cane? And then he's Thor, and I'm like, oh, so that's how
right.
He does. Okay.
Blake is, he is, and I'm throwing the big air quotes here, lame.
Right.
In physicality, not in creation.
Right.
Although he may be lame there too. But so he's always described as being lame, and so that gives license for him to always have the cane,
mm-hmm.
which is the connection to Thor's hammer, or the disguise Thor's hammer, or however it goes. Way back in the very first issue, Donald Blake was on vacation in the northern countries, Norway, Sweden, maybe, mm-hmm. somewhere like that. And he was ran into some aliens, and in running away from the aliens, ran into a cave, conveniently, stumbled onto this wooden cane, conveniently. And again, you know, you have to keep in mind that all of that stuff was set up by Odin to begin with.
Right, okay. So it's not convenient, it's ordained.
What happened is that Thor got a little too big for his britches, according to Dad, and Dad wanted to teach him a lesson, so he taught him a lesson by trapping him, I guess you would say, in the body of this lame earthling.
Mm. Well, that'll do it.
And then somewhere along the way, he allowed, I guess, the Earthling to find out that he was more than just an Earthling, and so Thor came back to... Not to Marvel readers, because he had never been around, but as far as the Asgardian lore, Thor came back at that point. Mm. He was free of his banishment.
Okay.
And that's kind of where the Marvel book picked up, and so now Thor can... I mean, Thor can be on Earth without having to be Donald Blake. You know, I mean, he can just travel from Asgard to here. While he's here, he can go back and forth between Blake and Thor, but humans are not allowed in Asgard, so he will seldom, if ever, transform to Donald Blake in Asgard, although every now and then he does because some magic person does something or something like that. So down here he can go back and forth at will, and the cane is the key. We then cut to Asgard, where we see Loki is having a gathering here of evil Asgardians.
Hmm.
Looking at this first drawing here of Kirby's, it's kind of difficult to see perhaps exactly who we're dealing with, mm-hmm. if it's anybody we should recognize. Ultimately, we do see who takes center stage is Ulic, the troll. The troll warrior, the strongest warrior, you said, or the
mightiest
warrior. He and Thor have butted heads before, and as Loki indicated here, Ulic has never won one of those butting of heads. So,
but he's going to this time.
Yeah, Loki's trying to drum up some. We need to get together and defeat the Asgardians / Thor together, mm-hmm. kind of business. That's what he's working at here.
Because, you know, he can't do it himself, so you all want your happy ending? Let's beat Thor!
And Loki has certainly tried up to this point, mm-hmm. but again, he's never been successful either. So Ulic steps up and says, you know, whatever it is you're planning is cool, but let's do something now. And that's where Loki says, well, you know, why now? You've not done anything to defeat Thor now before. And Ulic says, well, you know, he's ready this time. As Loki, I think more to get him out of the way so Loki can move on with his mm-hmm. Dastardly kind of plans. He says, okay, Ulic, here, poof, and he sends him to Earth. Says, okay, go ahead and do your thing.
Yep, we know now that you're going to do it, so I'm going to send you now.
Yeah, go ahead and beat Thor. That's cool. You know, so he sends him. Ulic materializes in the midst of this circus, which is funny. It strikes me as being very carnivalish, but
well, I mean, it's sort of like a Barnum and Bailey looking so far that I've seen.
Yeah,
I mean, it's got the tents and it's got the. Like the roll, the wheeled cages.
Yeah, the big cages on wheels, yeah. The wagons, or whatever you call them. Ulic is dropped into the middle of the circus and starts immediately yelling for Thor. That's all. He's not the brightest bulb in the pack, necessarily. And so once Ulic gets something in his head, that's what he does. So all he's thinking about is Thor. He doesn't really care where he is. I'm sure he doesn't know where he is.
I don't think it really matters to him.
He is somewhere. Loki said Thor would be here, exactly. So Ulic just immediately starts yelling for him.
Yep.
The
Ulic believe Loki.
The Circus of Crime pretty much attacks Ulic. And something I would be curious about, I don't know if anybody listening has any true life experience being a circus person or perhaps being a carny, but I've noticed in Marvel books that when the employees of a carnival or circus are in need of reinforcements, "Hey Rube" is what is yelled out to gather them.
Okay, see, I noticed that and I thought that it was somebody's name.
No, I have seen it in other books before. That is code for everybody to come running with weapons, apparently.
Huh, I'm going to have to look that up and see if I can find it out now, because when I read it, I was like, hey, Rube, what does that mean? Oh, that must be that dude's name, and now he's there.
Right. I have seen it before in Marvel books. I've never seen it in any other books, but then other books don't necessarily use, you know, carnivals and circuses and stuff. It would have to be books that have been around longer
right.
to really use that. But always when something happens and dude, a carny, needs backup, he yells, hey, Rube, and everybody within earshot comes running.
Huh.
So they do. Not really very effective against Ulic.
No.
Ulic is the best there is at what he does. Or no, wait a minute. That's not Ulic. That's somebody else.
He is the mightiest.
In the midst of this, the ringmaster comes running up to, you know, try to stop this. Because, among other things, Ulic is, like, really tearing up his circus here. So, ringmaster is there. The whole shtick behind ringmaster is he has a big top hat with a wheel on the front that spins, and the spinning wheel will hypnotize people, and they will then succumb to Ringmaster's will. He can give them commands, suggestions as to what to do. They fall under his control. So that's his thing. It does work on Ulic. He gets him to calm down, and they shuffle him off into one of the big wheeled cages there. In the midst of this, Thor, who approached the circus from where Donald Blake left the car off the side of the road back somewhere over there, has now made it into the circus in the midst of the cleaning up of this Ulic-ness. He does see that Ulic is here, mm-hmm. so he is aware. While he's kind of gathering his wits, figuring out exactly what he's going to do, where he's at, what's going on, everything like that. Another one of the Circus of Crime characters, Princess Python, comes up to him. Her shtick is that she is in control, telepathically, perhaps, never really sure, of a very, very large python.
Very large.
And the python is wrapping up Thor, and Princess Python is being, shall we say, amorous towards Thor, thinking the whole time that this is the circus's Thor strongman.
Mm-hmm.
She has no idea that it's the actual Asgardian god of thunder, Thor.
Yeah.
So she kind of is trying to get wit him, as you would say. He kind of puts her off, and she leaves, taking her snake with her. Curiously phallic, I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah.
You know, saying, okay, well, you know, after the show, we'll resume this. So we cut to the, later on that evening, under the big tent, the actual circus performance itself. And I've been to several circuses in my life, and I don't know that I have ever seen any ring as full of acts going on as this one is here.
I noticed the same thing.
When we first get here, man. This ring is packed.
It's like, how are they even doing, like, anything with so many, like, it looks like every single member of the troupe is, like, doing something somewhere in this panel.
Yeah. These people are certainly getting their money's worth who paid to go to this. I'll say that.
Yep.
In the midst of this, the Thor comes out, our Thor, the Asgardian god. I hesitate because thinking back, was anything said at the beginning of the book, Levi, that you can remember that the circus Thor would not be able to perform or would be anywhere or anything?
Actually, yeah, there was mention by Thor himself, I think it was back when he was changing, about it's a good thing I gave him, what is it, like an anesthetic to sleep, no, sedative, I'm sorry, since I gave the phony Thor a sedative to make him sleep all night, It's okay. Time for the genuine God of Thunder to appear.
Okay, I missed that. So when Donald Blake was there, he slipped Thor a Mickey, and then he took his place.
That's what it is.
Okay. Knowing the whole time he was going to do that to investigate the Circus of Crime here. So, all right, so Thor slips in doing what he assumes is his act, and nobody really seems to have issue with it, per se.
Well, this so one of the things I found interesting was, you know, it's like, oh, it's time for him to do his act, and the first thing I thought was, he's going to be found out because he's not going to know what to do.
And apparently that's okay.
It didn't matter because he just started doing his own thing, and it was okay.
Yeah, it worked. Up until the point, he did some whirling his hammer, and all of Thor's powers are tied into his hammer some way. Here, he's doing things by whirling the hammer around. Typically, he has to do things by tapping the handle of the hammer on the ground. Mm-hmm. But, okay, a creative license here.
You know.
And so things kind of go awry when, in the midst of everything, Thor hits the ground, causing a sonic shock, the ringmaster calls it, and it disrupts everything else apparently in the circus going on, which would be virtually everything, because I would imagine Thor came out while all this other stuff was going on too, so everybody's getting kind of shaken up. The audience is kind of rattled, but they like it because they think it's just part of the act, so they are clapping and yelling and everything like that, and Thor, oddly enough, really seems to be absorbing the adoration of the crowds. You can't necessarily say that he, you know, likes it or doesn't like it, because it's not that he doesn't interact in that way, but he does seem to the ringmaster says something about not hamming it up too much.
Yeah.
So here the Norse god of thunder really is enjoying the adoration of the public at this particular moment.
I think it's just the simple, you know, applause. It's the attention, because, I mean, Thor, when he does something, he likes to be noticed.
Yeah, it's just kind of unusual, because in the comic book, they haven't played that up a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
I have read other comics where things have happened to the gods over the years because they don't have those followers that they once had.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really cool novel, actually. You might enjoy the novel, called American Gods.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar? It's written by Neil Gaiman. And basically it's a story about the old gods having given way to the new gods, and perhaps not liking the fact that they had to give way to the new gods.
Right. Was that because of popular population adoration?
Yes, actually. It was directly tied into what people worshipped then and what people worship now.
Yeah. I've read a number of books where that is the theme of the power of the god is, you know, being directly related to the adoration of a number of followers.
That
said God has. So, yeah.
And Neil Gaiman did a really good job, because he mixed – he didn't focus on just one pantheon. Mm-hmm. He had representatives from multiple pantheons.
Mm-hmm.
Phoenician, Sumerian gods, African gods.
Oh, that would be interesting.
There were some Asgardians in there. Mm-hmm. There was some of the Greek and Roman gods in there, and a very, very entertaining novel. Neil Gaiman, American Gods, for those of you that may be interested in that.
Now, let me also interject, not about the book, but about Rube. There's actually a wiki on it, and from what it says, according to authors David Carlin. And Ken Emerson, the origins of the expression can be traced to 1848, when a member of Dan Rice's troupe was attacked at the New Orleans dance house. It says the man yelled for his friend named Reuben, who rushed to his aid.
Okay.
And so from then till now, it's been shortened to Rube.
The word or that occurrence?
No, the word has been shortened to rube, but it still is noted as being a term that's used by circus folk and carnies that is, you know, a cry for help, basically.
Okay, so that is that is an actual thing that they do.
Per the wiki.
Okay, well, let's go and, you know, take the wiki for what you can.
Exactly.
You know, who knows? Maybe it is, maybe it's not. But if it's not, somebody took the time to falsely support it.
They are also name dropped a couple large names. So if they're going to make a lie, they weaved it well. Or
yeah, they worked at it. So okay, that's interesting. So that could actually be legitimate. And one of the writers, or not one of the, but Stan Lee or somebody else who knew, introduced that into the Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Ethos? Universe and used it correctly, yep. Perhaps. That'd be pretty cool. All right. After Thor's act, the Ringmaster has told him, basically, okay, that's cool. Step aside, because I have a new act that's even better than you are. And the Ringmaster unveils Ulic, who, to show how amazing Ulic is, directs him to lift the world's only 5,000-pound barbell,
which is wow.
He's gonna what is this, Levi? A press? Do you know? Would that be a press? It's not a jerk.
No, it. It's some kind of
a
press.
Modified full press, mm-hmm. or something like that, up over his head, and then he tells Ulic to walk it over and put it on this truck. And as Ulic is, Thor decides that he has seen enough. I don't really know why, but he wakes Ulic up. Ulic immediately turns and starts attacking Thor, because Ulic, in his right mind, that's all he knows.
Thor, yeah, exactly.
At the moment, is to attack Thor. So, you know, it's like he's been asleep and he wakes up. And, of course, being that the only thing on his mind is attacking Thor, when he wakes up, that's immediately what he goes for.
Right.
And he happens to see him, so he does that. Much mayhem abounds. I don't think there's really anything – nothing really stuck out at me about the fight itself, except the culmination of the fight. Thor used his hammer and transported Ulic back to the Stygian realm that spawned him.
Yeah, which I didn't know that he could do.
It's early on, it is just really hard to keep up with, because what Thor does and how he does it with his hammer changed frequently.
So it was one of those, it's still new enough that we can throw something new in there?
I guess, you know, it's like, hey, who's going to argue? He can do this. He's never done that before. Well, it doesn't mean he can't.
Exactly. You've just never seen it up till now.
Right, exactly. We never watched the adventure where he did it previously, mm-hmm. so... So he does, and it looked like it was a nasty process, or there is a lot of smoke and
disintegration.
It seemed like a very negative process to me.
Yeah, it's got the Kirby bubbles, the energy bubbles.
Yeah.
And that almost never is good when he draws that.
Thor is left standing here amidst the almost ruin of where Ulic was, and turns his attention to the Circus of Crime, particularly the Ringmaster being the leader, and Thor is looking very darkly.
Yeah, I was just going to comment the first top panel and then the first panel in middle.
Right.
His face is shadowed.
Exactly. In the top one, it's completely shadowed.
Yep.
And then in the next shadow, there are low lights or highlights, whatever you would call them. You can see a face.
Mm-hmm.
In the other one, it was just a dark spot.
Yep.
So, yeah, so, you know, it's almost like in doing this, in banishing Ulic, Thor called upon, like, a darker side of his persona, and it's still there.
Yeah.
You know, almost like he, you know, controlled the black magic, and it still has a slight hold on him. And, you know, it's just very, very odd that that Thor all of a sudden is just very menacing.
I was thinking about this. I think the problem that Thor had, and we're seeing how he feels about the person who did it, is that though he may not like that evil creature Ulric, he is a worthy opponent. He is a worthy foe. And Thor likes a good fight. And if you're worthy, then he enjoys it even more. Well, to have seen him controlled by this mortal, him being Ulric, controlled by this mortal. Well, that's just insulting to both Ulric and to Thor.
Okay, I see where you're going.
And so that was, I think, why he released Ulric, because that'd have been me, I'd have been like, cool, one less bad guy that I gotta deal with. Fine.
Right.
But Thor's like, you know, no, he deserves a better fate, you know? I think that's where he was coming from.
Okay, so it's almost a Thor being the noble creature and having come across lesser nobility, and he's kind of reacting to that.
That's what I'm thinking.
Okay, I could very well see that, and you're right. And as guardian, good or bad, I could see Thor valuing a lot of ways more than a mere mortal.
Mm-hmm.
And that a mortal would deign to, you know, try to control
as guardian creature. Yeah.
Yeah. I could see that, I guess. And not only control him, but use him for evil.
Yeah.
You know, you do something nefarious with him. So
I mean, let him do evil himself. You, mortal, you know that he is better than that, even if he is evil.
Right. So Thor immediately knocks the ringmaster's hat off, which is the source of the only power that he has. Knocked his hat off so hard, as a matter of fact, that it changed the color of one of his boots in the next panel.
Did it? Hold on.
Because
oh, wow.
Blue and one boot is
yellow. Yep.
Yeah, so I'm not...
He didn't knock the socks off, but he knocked the color off one.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure what that means necessarily. But there it is. And immediately after facing off against the ringmaster, and kind of dispatching his powers, the circus is beset upon by the police, who Thor warned earlier that the circus of crime was in the area. So
and they're just conveniently now coming in at this moment.
Right. They have been on their way from time earlier.
Yes.
Whenever, and are just now arriving.
Yeah, whenever he broke out his cell phone and called the cops.
So the big brick thing
exactly.
In the bag.
It's Asgardian, so, you know, he's got, like, four rainbows.
Oh, there we go. It's a smart hammer?
Yeah, exactly. He types into the handle, you know, boop, beep, beep, boop, beep, beep.
And why not? Because in the movie, Odin whispered at the hammer and writing appeared on it.
Yep, that's true.
So it had voice to text already.
Yep.
So
yay for Siri.
The next several panels are the various members of the Circus of Crime being felled by mere police. We have the two acrobats, twin brothers. We have the clown riding on his unicycle,
which I think they should have handled more roughly.
Yeah, they.
Honestly, I think he should have tripped a couple times going to the squad car.
They tripped him out of the unicycle, basically. They had a pole that the unicycle ran into, and a clown went flying off of.
Which I enjoyed, I have to admit.
Now, Princess Python, however, is handled by Thor. And I suppose this is due to her interaction earlier in the story. Is why Thor would have. Now, why the writer, Stan Lee, decided to have Princess Python interact with Thor twice, one-on-one in the story, I'm not really sure. That's kind of interesting to me.
I think the second time here, when everyone's being apprehended, is simply because she's got this humongous python, and I mean, you know, reading it, basically, he's saying, you know, nothing's going to happen. You're not going to win with, you know, with this giant serpent, so long as there's someone that's stronger than it.
What was curious to me, though, is that the only one that he decided to take on – well, no, I guess that's not true. He took on the Ringmaster single-handedly also.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so never mind.
But, I mean, you know, like the clown is beneath him. The two acrobats beneath him. But this giant – and when I mean giant, I'm talking it's got to be, what, 30, 50 feet long?
Yeah, easily 1, 2, 3, 4 – five, yeah, probably easily 30 to 40 feet.
Yeah, so, and that's going to be a massive creature that only someone other than mortals are going to be able to dispatch quickly.
So now the circus of crime is wrapped up.
Sorry.
The
panel where she's wrapped in her own snake. Your puns, they're just so...
No pun intended.
You're just...
Come on, man.
All right.
The ringmaster finally steps up and says, well, you know, this is all good, but you don't have anything on us. We're just a lowly circus, a troupe. And Thor says, no, officer, here you go. And he walks over to the 500-pound barbell.
5,000-pound.
Or 5,000 pounds, excuse me, and gives it a mighty whack with Mjolnir. And all of the whatever – paper mache or whatever it is, falls off of the barbell, revealing thy government's own secret dual computer to be used for national defense. That's what Thor describes it as.
Which is 5,000 pounds.
Or if they have connected it, it is 2,500 pounds per computer.
Exactly.
And the computer's guys are... big spheres, not unlike the Death Star.
Yeah.
That's what it put me in mind of, were miniature Death Stars.
Well, you know, well, never mind, huh? Never mind.
Okay. And now that's like 5 years before the Death Star actually appeared, mm-hmm. So
ooh.
Perhaps something prophetic there.
Ooh.
Maybe Stan Lee had something to do with Star Wars.
Oh. I knew that man had his fingers in all kinds of stuff.
With that, George Lucas is the only one that could confirm that, and I'm sure you could never get him to admit it.
Oh, no, never.
And Stan Lee would not remember it
correctly. I was going to say, and Stan, I'm sorry, but Stan be like, George who?
Yeah, he's, you know, so,
I wrote what?
We may never know at this point. And now they're both under the same banner.
Yep.
Currently, Marvel Comics and Star Wars.
Yep.
So... I don't know. You know,
coincidence?
Who knows? So we hear the parting shot towards Thor is from Princess Python, asking him, you know, all you had to do is just be quiet, and we would have given you a cut. Why did you do this? And noble Thor indicates that so long as thou canst only think in terms of monetary gain, then verily, I say never, canst thou understand. So Thor in his nobleness flies away, and we see next issue the coming of the Crypto Man.
Crypto Man. I thought Thor's parting words were interesting well. For not till then will humanity fulfill its promise. And I'm like, promise? Nay, not till then. Okay, till then what? Will man and God be one? And I was like, what?
Until man exhibits the nobleness that Thor has?
I don't know.
Until they can get past monetary gain? We humans, I mean.
Until we transcend?
Perhaps.
I don't know. I thought that was interesting and a bit, I don't know, foreshadowing maybe?
It could be. Could be. I mean, that's a couple things come to mind. That certainly sounds like something that Thor would say the way that Marvel has pretty consistently written him.
Mm-hmm.
He has always seen more in humanity than humanity has seemed to be able to give. That also is a theme that is very prevalent the more Stan Lee books you read.
I was just going to say, the more Stan is involved in a book.
Yeah, he has this...
altruistic.
Okay. The unrecognized, the unshown,
the unpacked
nobility, yeah, of the human spirit.
Yep.
That is a theme that Stan writes on, to the extent that he even created a character completely attempting to encompass that concept. That character being the Silver Surfer.
Oh God!
That's all the Silver Surfer is a spacefaring knight.
Yep.
He is the Stan's, I think, ultimate expression of nobility, mm-hmm, of humanity.
Yep.
Is Silver Surfer. So, and Thor, Asgardians, a court, regalness,
yep,
nobility would be a pretty easy extension of those types of characters also.
Yeah, it's very Arthur-esque.
Yes. Yeah, it is. And, you know, at this point, 1970, Stan Lee's been writing for a little while, but he's still a younger man. So perhaps that's a reflection of where he's coming from, having grown up with the types of entertainment and literature that he had.
Right. And it could also be the man's attempt to inspire and do better through a media.
Okay. It could be. Absolutely.
Because you're not going to be hitting at this time 20, 30, 40 plus year old people.
Oh, no.
You're going to be, you know, hitting teens, preteens, and
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, you have the potential to inspire, mm-hmm, still at this point with a comic book.
Yep.
And also I'll be the first to admit that I'm not sure why per se. I mean, of course, I understand these types of bigger concepts, but those are always some of the most difficult things for me to see in comic books, I guess, because I just don't think of comic books as having them. Those meta kind of things.
Well, but I mean, if you look at a lot of the earlier ones, wouldn't they have been started with that goal in mind? I mean, it wasn't necessarily entertainment. I mean, dude, look at Superman.
Yeah. No, you're right. I mean, sure, it's very, very possible. I mean, I certainly can't say that it wasn't.
And yes, I understand Superman is different.
One of the goals, you know, in the creation of a lot of these characters, the usage of a lot of themes and whatnot. I guess, I mean, I have always been kind of hesitant to say a lot of things like that unless I have actually heard it from the creator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's just me.
But, I mean, with Stan, it's so consistent.
Yeah, and it gets to be much more obvious the more of his creations you read.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point in Marvel, his creations are many. So if you read the beginnings of a lot of the Marvel mainstays for 10, 15, 20 issues each, yeah, it's a certainly reoccurring theme, almost like that was his only intent,
right,
was getting across this theme, character after character after book. So I don't know if he ever thought that he achieved it. A lot of stuff that I'll see him attached to nowadays when stuff comes out doesn't seem quite as I don't know, ambitiously noble, if I can put those words together, as a lot of this earlier stuff, so I don't know.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I only consume like the visual on a regular basis that Stan's associated with, being, you know, TV shows, movies, and things like that. And the overt nobility that was in the comics like this is not there now. I don't know if that's because, you know, he has lessened in his belief, or if he just understands that that's not going to make the money.
Right. Yeah. You always have to wonder how involved he really is in things nowadays.
Oh yeah.
Being 2 million years old.
Yeah. Exactly.
You see his name attached. It's like.
I mean, you know, it's just it's funny to see him in the movie, and you're like, oh no, Stan. That's right, Stan Lee. Han, what did he say about that scene, though?
Yeah, yeah. All right, so the Moore Brothers voting, do you give this a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
I'm going to give it a thumbs up, but I am going to say this. Their bold inflection in this issue was insane.
Okay.
Some Bubbles had like every third word like bolded for inflection, and trying to read it with that in mind, it like it doesn't make sense. Like no one,
right.
No
read
one
it,
would
read
talk
it the
like
way
that.
It's written.
Yeah, it's like no one would talk like that. It's like I have come to help you with the problem of, and it's like no, that doesn't work, dude.
Really.
Other than that, yeah, I'll give it a thumbs up. I thought it was interesting. This was my first experience with the gang, and with Ulick.
Okay.
So yeah, thumbs up.
I also give it a thumbs up. The Thor character from Marvel is one of my favorite long-term characters that I have read over the course of my couple years of comic book reading. So. I've always enjoyed Thor, particularly when he faces. Thor has a history of facing more and less worthy opponents. Some of his first appearances in Marvel Comics, he fought gangsters and evil scientists from the future.
Right.
And you know, I was always like, "Oh, really?
This is
I
Thor, mean, dude?
Yeah, you've got." You've got all of Asgard you can play with, and he comes here to get Muggsy Matarkin and his bank robbers, you know,
and the Gambino brothers.
But I enjoy Thor much more when he is fighting. It doesn't have to be Asgardian, but something more worthy of the Norse god of storm,
right?
You know, so. Okay, before we move on to the next book, which is X-Men issue 65, and I will explain why I felt it was kind of sad, I believe we have something to insert here.
We do, yes. Last episode, we called for a word of the show. We checked Google, we checked Facebook, we checked our email. We checked the site, and we checked Twitter. But alas, we had no challenges for word of the show. So,
alas.
Alas, indeed. The bronze, sorry.
No.
So, guys, you're going to listen to this. You know where to go. We tell you at the end of the show. Give us a word to you. Challenge us. Challenge us. I'm challenging you to challenge us. Give us a word that you think we can't use in the show. I dare ya.
So there you go, guys. That is Levi dropping the mic on stage and walking off. Basically.
Just turned it, dropped, walked away.
So there we go. Alrighty, X-Men issue 65.
Yay!
sad because apparently a lot like my brother, X-Men is one of my all-time favorite comic creations from Marvel.
Yes, sir.
Which that is not sad. That's really cool.
Yes, it is.
What's sad is that at issue 66 in this particular volume of X-Men, we do not see any new X-Men for several years.
That is sad.
So we're jumping into this. This story we perhaps have kind of some issues with. But regardless, we only have one more new story, and then the book, because of sales, they keep the book around, but it goes into reprints. Total reprints, not even, you know, a new eight-pager in there. No, it's a total reprint book from 67 to 93, not on a monthly schedule.
Wow.
The book was not coming out monthly. I believe it was coming out bi-monthly. So you're looking at not a three-year span there, but a six-year span or thereabouts.
That is sad, actually. That really is.
In real time. And it's particularly considering where the X-Men fit now,
mm-hmm.
and the names that they have attached to this book, mm-hmm. even at this time, are some of the greats at the time. And they still could not pull these characters out of the doldrums and keep it from going into reprints.
And see this issue, it had the classic team.
Yes,
it did. It had the ultimate classic team.
So I'll drop this right now at the beginning. I enjoyed this very much.
I did too.
I like these characters. I like this iteration of these characters. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I first really got into comic books a little while after they reintroduced the X-Men and mm-hmm. some of these other characters that have gone on to be the real big ones now. But I always have had a fondness for maybe not the first year-ish or 18 issues of the X-Men because it was kind of rough. Everybody was still kind of feeling their way as far as creating the mythos and the world.
Right.
But, you know, into the 20s and 30s numbered issues all the way up until now, really enjoy that period of the original characters. The cover of this, we have the original five characters.
Yes.
Fighting dude that I had never seen before.
Me neither.
And having read the story, I think I kind of see why, because he's not a character himself per se. He's a lackey.
He's a prop.
But I will say, this book and Thor, the cover directly ties into the story,
yep.
and that's groovy.
Yep.
That is cool. So we have this big almost, I guess, lizardy kind of looking bipedal dude with fins running down the back of his head and probably on down his spine, but you can't see because he's kind of turned. He is semi-intelligent because he's wearing a cod piece maybe, or a loincloth of some sort.
And a utility belt.
Yeah, so he is trying – he is showing some modesty here. We have –
Well, I mean, given, you know, size and perspective.
Well –
You know,
we have Beast and Marvel Girl laying at his feet. Angel having been swatted away
like a fly. That's insulting.
And Cyclops and Iceman attacking with the energy that they have at their command. Cyclops with his laser eye blast and Iceman with streams of what appear to be snow.
Mm.
As Angel is falling, he's saying, "Get him, Cyclops, it's up to you and Iceman now."
That's one of the things I think I enjoy the most about covers is when they include text.
Okay, how come?
Because it seems more interactive and to draw me in more instead of just being a picture, even though it does – lead into what is inside this instance, it just seems more interactive. It's like I don't have to wait to start reading the comic book after the first two pages once I get past Arnold Schwarzenegger and some small chick on his shoulder.
Oh, come on now.
I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm just saying.
Okay, I was going to say, those are some classic
ads. No, they're classic. I love seeing those, too. I'm just saying, I don't feel like I have to wait until after the front cover and Arnold to get into it, because here he is, he's talking. I'm already reading the comic book.
Okay, and by text, you mean something that they're saying,
yes,
rather than this text at the bottom of the cover.
Yeah,
which is more narration.
Narration, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah, as opposed to something that the characters are actually saying, which there's a really cool word for that, but it's escaping me.
Yeah.
Not text. But,
yeah, me too. I don't know.
Yeah. Anyways, okay. And something that caught me about the cover is, at first it looks like they're – plus because of this creature they're fighting, it looks like maybe they're on a spaceship or something like that. But – you see kind of off in the distance here what looks to be a very Earth city.
Yeah.
Not necessarily anyone in particular that I could tell looking at it, but
I don't know, maybe New York. That could be the Bronx Bridge or something.
Yeah, you would assume New York because of Marvel being there, but yeah, so kind of a combination of things. Well, they're near Earth somehow, but that doesn't look like they're
on
in an earthly thing or something. So and yes, as Levi said, we cut past the what is it here? The big muscle building book by Joe Wider, with Arnold holding a frail in his arm while he's bicep flexing the other one.
He was a big boy,
very large, Mr. Olympia, Mr. Universe,
both maybe.
Both universe, says Chef Terry.
Oh, okay.
She having kept up with the bodybuilding world.
Evidently. Oh,
this is something new we must explore.
A facet. Mm-hmm.
Then the next page is the first of our story. The most X-Men, the most unusual fighting team of all time. Before I'd be slave. And slave is the word is wrapped in chains. And that kind of really stuck out to me.
Yeah.
And now that I've read the book and thought about it for a second, do we understand what that reference means?
Evidently not. I didn't know it was a reference.
Was there something in the book that indicated a chained up slavish kind of
guess
the story itself of the aliens.
I thought you meant like be slave was some. No, the slave is very much in reference to the story, yes.
Right, okay. The five original X-Men, Scott, Jean, Hank, Bobby, and Warren. Okay.
Warren
took me a second there.
The third.
Are returning from somewhere. They are at the mansion, and waiting for them on the stairs of the mansion are Polaris and Havoc.
Polaris, okay, that's who that was.
They never
used her mutant name. They only used,
did they never drop her name?
I don't think so. They only used her. How did they refer to it as her slave name? X-Men First Class.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of what Havoc's name is, and I can't.
Let's see here.
Scott.
Yeah,
and Alex Summers.
Summers, yeah.
And Lorna Dane. That's her name.
Yeah. And they only use Lorna in the comic.
Alex. Okay. Yeah, her name is Polaris.
Oh, okay.
And at this point in their careers, back up a second. All of the X-Men now have graduated from when they were originally in the school, big quotes there, the way I said that, and Xavier was instructing them. since for a while they have graduated, and the significance of their graduation is the ability to wear the colorful costumes that they have, as opposed to those Bumblebee kind of costumes mm-hmm. that they wore initially. So for anybody out there that has noticed anything like that and you haven't actually read all of the issues, that's what happened there. The one was the student uniforms, which pops up again in other Marvel mutant student books. Mm-hmm. It's a theme that they reuse. It's a black and yellow, rather drabbish uniform. And then the when you graduate, you get to pick your uniform, and so that's when all bright colors and spandex come out. Mm-hmm. Or if you're in the 90s, all the leather and pockets come out.
Exactly.
And, you know, just depending on what your thrill is there. So
what year you graduate.
Yeah. Lorna and Havoc are wearing their more colorful uniforms. Lorna's is very miscolored, actually. Hers is supposed to be green, which when you first see her here, it is not green.
No, not at all.
Her hair is green, too, and it's kind of green here. But, the uniform is green, a different shade from her hair, and her hair is green also. Okay, I'm sorry, guys, for all that background. The X-Men are coming home from a mission where they have fought consecutively Magneto and Sunfire, who's another mutant from Japan. And they're coming home to, you know, they're just wanting to chill, to take a break. They've been working. This is their weekend. But Havoc and Polaris are like, no, come on, we got to go. Such that the X-Men are telling them, no, we need to rest. And Polaris says, no, picking up a lamppost with her magnetic powers and forcing them into the house. You need to come with us.
Yeah, Hank didn't take that well.
No, Hank kind of reacts negatively to that, grabs the lamppost and bends it in his hand, mm-hmm. throws it back at Alex. Bobby Drake kind of helps the lamppost along with an arctic blast. Havoc, using his power, disintegrates the pole and stops the Bobby's blast. They almost come to blows here because Alex and Lorna want them to do something and the X-Men don't want to do anything.
It's like when did you, you know, get in charge of us?
Yeah, yeah. You're not the dad of me. Oh, boss of me. I'm sorry. You're not the boss of me and that's all it is. The X-Men are tired and they want to rest. And here's these two people that they know full well. Havoc is Scott's brother.
Yeah.
And they both know that.
Younger brother, I believe, yes.
And so they're like, you know, no, we have to do something now. And the X-Men are simply trying to explain, no, brother, now is very tired and sleepy time. So they kind of compromise. Scott? Scott is the voice of reason, mm-hmm. which nowadays in the Scott character, you would never
no,
see that.
Not in the comics.
Scott is not remotely the voice of reason now.
No.
But he was here, and so the X-Men decide to...
But that's because his feels got broke.
Yes, yeah, of course, because it's his brother.
Right.
They decide to help, and I thought was cool. After they agreed to help, the next five panels, each panel is of one of the X-Men getting into costume, thinking about either what's going on or what has just gone on or something like that. But we start the book as a group, and the first many panels are as a group. And then all of a sudden, we get some individuality by having a panel of each character going through something by his or herself.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought that was a cool storytelling device. Probably has some fancy French name I'm not aware of.
Well, I mean, it lent to individuality, but it also lent to I don't know, three-dimensionalizing the comic, in that not everyone is thinking about what is going on now, or what, you know, what all this is about, or what they're going to encounter when they get to the computer room.
Okay. Yeah.
Like with Warren, you know, he's getting dressed, and he's like, every time I put on again, on. Every time I put on these duds, I've got to wonder if I'll be buried in them.
Yeah, yeah, we see that Warren apparently is going through some sort of crisis here.
But it just, you know, it was interesting, like you said, because it's like, I don't know, gives a humanness to it.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, and for those five panels, they're not the X-Men.
Right.
They are
individuals,
you know,
people.
Bobby and Jean mm-hmm. and Scott, and yeah, so just a simple little thing, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think much of it, but it showed that again, they're more than just team.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think each panel was necessarily enough to really say that there was a character development kind of thing going on there, but you see that it's not all about the team, either in the writer's mind or in the character's mind.
Right, exactly.
A lot more going on.
I mean, okay, so, like, you know, with Bobby, he's thinking about Lorna.
Yeah, he's recently had this thing for Lorna.
And, you know, he flat out says, so I love her. Why? Because he, you know, he's like, I shouldn't be uptight about Lorna. Da 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 da. He's like, but it's because I love her. That's why.
Okay, Bobby. Take it easy, dog.
I know, right? Cool down. Take a cold shower, Bobby.
And probably something to keep in mind, too, I guess. These guys are probably only 18, 19 years old, maybe 20. So, I mean, they're, you know, still very, very early in their lives. And I think of all of them, if I recall, Jean Grey, I believe, is the oldest.
Mm.
So however old they may be, I believe Jean is like a couple years older than any of them.
I thought Hank would have been the older one.
No, I seem to – well, okay, it could be.
Because I know Bobby was the youngest.
Right, but I seem to recall that Jean had been with Professor a while before he gathered the boys.
But, well, but that doesn't mean that she was older, just that she was there longer.
True, but I just kind of...
wonder if there's someplace that we can get their ages.
Oh, maybe. I'm not sure. Because a lot of times they're so iffy on giving ages to begin mm-hmm. with, so that you can't pin it down.
Right.
But, other than, yeah, like you said, Bobby is absolutely the oldest because or youngest because that's stated
yeah.
before in other places. And then as far as Scott and Alex, Scott is the older brother.
Mm-hmm.
That is expressly stated here and there. The rest of them, until we find out otherwise, I think I'm going to stick to the fact that I seem to recall that Gene was the oldest of the group.
Okay.
All right. And I want to say that somewhere that comes out from the professor himself.
Oh, okay.
He's talking maybe to Scott or maybe to the group as a whole, or maybe he's talking to her, reassuring Gene at some point about something. But it sticks out in my mind because it's odd
yeah.
that the one girl on the team would be the oldest.
Well,
not by, you know, not by 5 or 10 years, but just by
one or two,
maybe a year or two.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And especially, yeah, back in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially.
There we go.
Okay. So the X-Men, they gather all down here in the, you said it a second ago, Levi.
The computer room.
Yeah. Okay. And there's this image of something up here that they're discussing around. Just a, I don't know, some dude that's not human.
No.
And what got me until later on in the story is how in the world Alex had come by this treasure trove of information that he's handing out.
Yeah, I mean, it was like, this is important. You need to know it. This is what I know. I know a lot. And it's like...
And it's about an alien invasion of Earth.
But also an alien race that is, what, millennia old?
Yeah, he's going way back in their history talking about things.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they're from the Andromeda Galaxy. For those of you that know the Marvel Universe out there, the alien race is the Xenox, Z'NOX. And a representative is what is first up on the screen when we first get in the computer room.
their representative. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
And it's not a very good representative because they kind of change later on.
Yeah.
When you see them. But so Alex is filling them in on this impending invasion of Earth. And then he goes into what will happen ultimately because the Znox world is in the solar system approaching Earth. The planet itself is approaching Earth.
Yeah, it just passed Saturn.
As the invasion, you know, so it's not a whole bunch of ships, it's the planet.
And you know, here it is. About a millennia ago, Znox scientists devised the ultimate weapon. Now, I'm not going to get into more detail, but this weapon that they're using basically to get around in space to move their entire planet was built, or rather devised, let's say built, a millennium ago.
Right. According to Alex Summers.
Yeah.
The Earth Boy.
Yeah, the all-knowing.
So
Havok.
So he has given out the basically the mission parameters. We have to stop this invasion. And of course the X-Men are like, what? But not forcefully. Scott jumps up and says, for your sake, I hope you're telling the truth, brother, because if you're not, and, you know, Alex says that he is telling the truth, Lorna takes up for Alex, which you would expect Lorna to do, and simply says, he's not lying.
I know. He's not.
Wow. Yeah, that's...
That is a compelling argument, Lorna.
That is support there.
Right there.
Got your back.
He's not.
In the midst of the argument, we see that Jean has started crying.
Yeah, that threw me.
Scott notices and asks, "What's, you know, is everything all right? What's going on?" We then cut to Alex, who drops the big bomb announcement.
The X-bomb.
That Charles Xavier is alive.
And if you had not read any issues prior to this,
how would you know? Yeah. Apparently, the professor has been dead, Stan says, since issue 42.
So, what was
this? This is 50 or 65, so that's almost 2 years Professor X has been dead.
In issues, I thought they said it was something like 5 months.
Yeah, something like that, 5 or 6 months. Yeah,
yeah. Like in issue storyline-wise, timeline-wise, it was like only 4 or 5 months.
The professor then takes up Alex's story, because apparently the professor is the source of the information that Alex has been passing on to them. Now, that being the case, I don't understand why the professor didn't just appear and what was the point of having Alex tell them the story and then bring out the professor?
Well, here's a better question. Why didn't he tell his X-Men to begin with? Why bring in Havoc and what? Face.
Well, yeah, I mean, he does say that he has used the time to suss out what the Znox were doing,
okay,
how they were going to do it, and everything like that. So basically, he has been using the time to gather this information. But I don't know that it's ever been said that that is why he did it. So,
it's just. I don't know. It's just odd. I mean, I get, you know, the whole side of, well, I wanted to keep you all out of it because I knew you would interfere, da-da-da-da-da. But then the other half of me is like, but if you told them, like, right at the beginning, like, none of this would be happening right now.
Well, as a writer, would it not have been more dramatic to have them just, you know, go back to the house like they've done dozens of times before? Only this time the professor is sitting there?
Well, yeah, of course, as a writer, but you know, but then I still require a little bit of suspension of disbelief.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I'm not I'm not sure what this was meant to do other than give an avenue for Alex and, or excuse me, for Havoc and Polaris to be in on the mission.
Right.
So.
And I mean, the professor, they could have brought them in. You know?
Exactly. I mean, he could have just said, and Alex and Lorna have decided to help us, and we're gonna pick them up here on the way there.
Or if he wanted, you know, like drama, you know, he'd have been like, and I've been secretly working with, you know, and,
okay.
and everyone's
yeah.
like, and not us, you know.
So
I don't know. The writer's motivation is just confusing to me.
It's odd. Yeah, the whole setup is odd. Professor goes into explaining some other things that happened. Apparently the professor himself physically bowed out before his apparent death.
Right. He actually didn't die.
Right. Well, not only that, but such that the death was an impersonator
yep.
that had been in place for a little while prior to the death.
Mm-hmm.
And the professor didn't do that because he thought that something was going to happen, that he would die.
Right.
He stepped out, got an impersonator, and then just in the course of being impersonated, that substitute was killed.
Which, reading it and putting the timeline together makes me a wonder. The professor was dead for, like we said, like 4 or 5 months in story.
Right.
This could have happened at the beginning. You know, with him and what's this guy's name? The Changeling.
Changeling. Yeah.
So this could have happened at the beginning of that, or even months before. But the interesting thing is, Charles knew about this months before what we're reading right now.
Right.
And has been making all of these plans for all of that time. I thought that was interesting.
Okay. And you know, I think that probably what a lot of that was Creator 1 killed him, and Creator 2 was giving the task of bringing him back.
Right.
And so, you know, the two don't necessarily match up beyond just a certain point.
Right. It's like, all right, now, it's your job to bring him back. I don't care how you do it.
Right. Yeah. And you know, he's saying, "Well, I can't explain everything," and they're like, "Oh, that's okay."
You know. Oh, okay. We don't need facts.
Yeah, just fit it in there as best you can, mm-hmm. and just move forward.
Pretty much.
Which is funny because again, he's coming back this issue and next issue, and then they go on hiatus basically. So you're like, "Well, why did you even bring him back? You had to know that you were going to cut the book off at that point. You had to know."
Well. Okay. I mean, maybe they didn't. Maybe it was a last-minute thing.
Yeah, could
because
be.
I agree. You don't bring back a major character, and I mean, like, major character.
Oh, yeah.
And then be like, you know, a book later, all right, and this is it. Have fun, guys.
Okay. Perhaps. Fishiness.
Yeah.
Just Marvel 70 fishiness, I think, with the book going on there.
The Bronze Age.
The professor, apparently he has a little bit of leeway here because he sends all of the X-Men into intensive training for the next few hours. So he even has the attack timed. He knows when this alien race is going to be where
mm-hmm.
they're going to be.
Yep.
So he not only intensifies the X-Men's training, but from what it looked like to me, he maybe even gives them task-specific training.
Yeah, mission-specific training, yeah, most definitely.
Yeah, which ultimately doesn't necessarily turn out to be that way, I don't think.
I got three connections from it.
Really? Jean does her Jean thing.
Yeah, but now also Hank does his robot thing.
Right.
And Bobby does his cooling thing.
Oh, he does with Jean.
No, he was actually touching Scott.
But I mean that whole thing.
Yes.
The Jean part
yeah.
of it. He was
yeah.
in. Well, no, I guess you could say that Scott also did it too, because didn't he fire, didn't he concentrate this beam and fire it?
Yeah, but I don't know because, okay, we're talking because we know it and they don't. Concerning Scott, Scott says, "How am I doing, sir?" And Xavier says, "Not well enough. Narrow your beam. Put all your energy into a spot no more than a micrometer wide." Now, that will become relevant later and will add into what we're talking about now as to the training that Xavier is putting them through now and its relevance.
Yeah, not as specifically as the other three.
Exactly.
But he does do something.
He does.
Kind of similar. So, okay. So, yeah, I guess all four of them are mission specific.
Though, what's funny, though, is Angel, of course, left out.
Yeah. He doesn't have a role. Sorry.
I mean, it's like, just fly around.
Your support, your backup.
Yeah. Like your air support. Like your recon.
Now, the next panel is a cool panel, because it shows a 1970 version
of the helicarrier.
Of a helicarrier.
And seriously, when I turned that page, I was like, whoa, that's the alien ship? And then I started reading, and I'm like, no, that is not alien ship. And it's just, it's all like sleek and silver and awesome. I mean, dude. Growing up, that would have been probably the most awesome thing I would have seen in a comic book.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just think, okay, for those people who were kids who picked this book up off the stands and read this, and helicarriers at this point had appeared in a couple other books at this time, but taking this one, and then just a year or two ago finally seeing this bad boy on the movie screen. Can you imagine how that must have been? What was going through those people's mind?
I mean, you know, it's like we have this idea. It's going to be an aircraft carrier, but it's going to be in the air, and it's going to be able to do this, do that, and it needs to, and it would, and this is what they did. And it's like, wow, this is what they did.
Yeah.
In all honesty, being a kid, there was only one other ship that was as cool as what this looks like, and it was, what was it called, the USS Flag?
Oh, yeah. The G.I. Joe
aircraft carrier.
Yeah.
To me, personally, there is only one other that was as cool as what this looks like.
Now, S.H.I.E.L.D., some of you might be asking, given that we are talking about the helicarrier, what are they doing? Well, apparently, there was a scout ship that the Xenox had sent that landed, crash-landed.
The Southern Magnetic Pole.
Landed on Earth that S.H.I.E.L.D. was aware of, and they were investigating. So that's now.
Because they're S.H.I.E.L.D.
The expert, well, not the expert, Professor Xavier now has, from the very early days, had a connection to the FBI,
mm-hmm.
but not to S.H.I.E.L.D. In recent continuity, though, they have built some connections to S.H.I.E.L.D., but early on, he didn't have any. And you can see here that he must not have had any, because he didn't know S.H.I.E.L.D. was going to do this, and S.H.I.E.L.D. doing this kind of threw off his plans for his X-Men mission,
mm-hmm.
Such that they had to move up the mission time.
Yeah, like immediately. Well, that's funny.
From not whenever it was, but to now.
Right now, yeah.
We have to do it now. So,
which makes me wonder, does he know as much as he says?
He had, this is a pretty complicated plan.
It must have been. I mean, because he's been, for months he's been planning, like, first he's been tracking, like,
their movements and just everything, and then trying to figure out their weaknesses and then how best the X-Men, his X-Men, can do it and everything. So, I mean, it's taken brain power. That's yeah. for sure.
So they gather up. They Professor wishes the X-Men and Polaris and Havoc good luck and send them on their way. We go to the Zanox. This is the Zanox ship that's at the pole. Okay. That S.H.I.E.L.D. Was investigating. And they are defending themselves against initially what appears to be the S.H.I.E.L.D. attack.
Yeah, which they won and S.H.I.E.L.D. lost horribly.
Yeah. And then we find out that the X-Men are in a really cool aircraft, spaceship thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that works.
Really, themselves, because it has layers like an onion. And as it's being hit by the defenses of the Zanox craft, that shell is destroyed by whatever the defense is, but the remainder of the ship underneath is intact.
Yep, it just keeps going. It
just keeps going, losing layers.
Yep, it gets hit, it explodes, and then boom, the ship with that's left keeps going.
Until it's just the delivery ship itself, which crashes into, I pictured kind of embeds itself almost like a hypodermic into the Zanox vessel.
Yeah.
The end piece finishes drilling into the ship. Not that the crashing of the ship was enough to penetrate the hull of the Zanox ship,
right.
Apparently.
Yeah.
But it has to twist and drill into, and then the drill opens up and the X-Men exit through that drill site at the end. So they have now gained entry. Initially we see that it's Beast, Iceman, and Cyclops. They gain entry into the Zanox ship and are immediately attacked by this dude who bears a striking resemblance to dude that was on the front cover.
Yep.
Apparently, this is a roving, almost like defense creature that the Zanox employs. It's their first line of internal defense.
Yeah, like a guard or something they called it.
Yeah.
I don't remember.
Yeah, I don't remember it either. They called it Fido, but
did they? The X-Men called it Fido.
Yeah, Hank called it, I think, Fido.
Oh,
or Bobby.
Guardian Beast. There it is.
Okay, Guardian Beast.
Yeah, leader. The intruders have disabled our Guardian Beast.
Oh, yes. Okay, yeah, they're talking about it. All right, so the X-Men attack this beast. And then the next panel is a news broadcast of what is happening to the Earth as the Zanox
homeworld,
whatever it is approaching. Mm-hmm. It's starting to, which we've all seen before, it's starting to wreck all kinds of environmental, weather, tectonic havoc.
Right, the seas and the coming and the going of the seas is being affected because of gravity,
right.
And everything.
Tides and earthquakes.
Tides, yeah.
All that stuff. An island has sunk.
Yeah.
We then cut to the planet itself, who is talking things over with their scout craft that is at the South Pole.
Mm-hmm.
South Pole. I need to remember that because that brings something to mind a little bit later on.
The South Magnetic Pole.
Yes, I'm sorry. Not the true South, but yeah,
right.
South
Because they made a point. I thought it was odd. They made a point to say magnetic. South Magnetic
Pole. I'll see if you picked up on something else here interesting, too. The X-Men continue advancing towards what I guess is the control room, mm-hmm. Of this scout craft. not we're starting to see perhaps some of the training that the professor specifically put them on first, put them through first with Beast.
Yep.
With some of the things that Beast is doing, and he's fighting some larger robots here. They then cut back to the X-Men, Professor X, who stayed in, I would assume, Westchester, because that's where his mansion's always been. And he's talking to Lorna,
who is
calling her to him. So apparently Lorna, even though she was with the group when they left, it looked like, did not actually leave with them.
Yeah, she apparently stayed.
Right. Professor X has further plans, you know, other than just sending the X-Men to the scout craft is more a diversion than the actual mission, the actual attack that he's going to wage on the Xenox.
Okay.
Professor X instead is going to reach out telepathically across the world, join all that can participate, and there are various reasons as he's doing this that he sees that people cannot participate despite their will. Not that they're doing it against their will, but not that he has necessarily asked everyone on the planet to participate. So the people are participating beside their will, I guess. He's not forcing them, but neither did he ask to use their ability to be compassionate.
Right. But I don't think that he's using them. Well, no. I don't think that he's compelling them. I think what he's doing is drawing that compassion from them, that genuine compassion. Because, I mean, you know, he says some he rejects immediately because to distract them would be to cause irreparable harm, surgeons and pilots.
Right. They're in the midst of something.
Right.
Okay.
Others he dismisses because he finds their psyches tainted with hatred, cruelty, blah, blah, blah.
They have no compassion.
Right. So I don't think that he is making them do anything. I think that he is channeling that emotion. And when we see the reaction that the Xenox have, I think that makes more sense. He's not making the humans and or mutants, beings, whomever may be on the planet. He's not making them do anything. I think he's just channeling that compassion, that love, I don't know if it says specifically what he was looking for, but you know, I think that he's just channeling that.
Okay. Lorna is by his side here, and he artistically, you can see that he is doing something requiring great energy.
Yeah, I do like that effect. I really do.
He says, I can't keep millions of personalities united for long. Now here, you must direct my mental emanations to Death Valley. Focus your attention on the X-Men. I was not aware, A, that the magnetic South Pole was in Death Valley.
Me neither.
Nor that B, the X-Men were in Death Valley.
Yeah, see that?
So what happened there?
I don't know. It threw me. I had to read it like twice because I was like...
Because they're in New York,
yeah.
The professor
yeah.
is. So basically he's just going to be shooting something just across the country to Death Valley. The X-Men are somewhere in southern South America, I guess is where the magnetic South Pole would be. Nowhere near. I don't, you know, was there some sort of relay thing going on at Death Valley that then shunted it?
Yeah, that's what I thought. But then reading on, there was no evidence of that.
No. What they're doing gets to the X-Men.
Directly.
That's all you know.
Yep.
So now we see that the X-Men are holding their own in the scout ship, but holding their own in a losing effort. It's only a matter of time before they won't be able to maintain their position.
Right.
Now, for the first time, we see that Havoc is with the original five X-Men. Mm-hmm. So he did go on the mission with them.
Yep.
Professor is communicating telepathically with Jean, who, if we remember back to the training, he was working with Jean to funnel something, like mm-hmm. a pipeline.
Yep.
So as we watch this compressed, collected compassion mm-hmm. that Professor X has gathered mentally as aimed magnetically by Polaris, because that's her power,
right.
is the ability to manipulate Earth's magnetic fields, sounds very similar to someone else we know. And there's a reason for that.
Ooh.
Directs that towards Death Valley.
Yeah.
Which, okay, apparently it gets to Jean, which of course is the important part.
Right. We'll just skip the, you know.
Right. No explanation. It's magic.
Right.
Okay. That's cool. So this energy wave beam gets to Jean.
Mm-hmm.
Jean directs it at Havoc.
Yep.
Havoc absorbs it, converts it, sends it to Cyclops, mm-hmm. to Scott.
Yep.
Iceman is chilling Scott because absorbing all of this energy is going to – a lot of the energy, all of you physics people know, is going to be converted to heat.
Right.
Heat. Yeah. So Iceman is keeping things chill.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got Professor firing.
Right.
Lorna aiming.
Right, to Death Valley. But that's not important.
No, no. The beam hits Jean. Who sends it to Alex.
Alex, telepathically.
Who converts it
into cosmic
and sends
rays,
it to Scott.
Right, to his soul.
Now Scott fires the beam at the incoming Znox planet.
Yes.
Now, it's not a destructive beam.
No.
Because when it strikes the planet, they're not trying to blow the planet up or shake it apart or anything like that. For the next several pages, mm-hmm. we have 2 3-panel
pages.
Not columns, but what do they go? Lines,
yeah.
I guess, going across. And the theme is the same. We see a representative of Earth who is giving the compassion.
Right.
We see Jean, Havoc, Scott, and Bobby
right.
combined firing the beam.
Yes.
And then we have a panel of a or the result on the Znox planet and or the inhabitants thereof.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 2, 4 rows of this same setup.
Yep.
We see that the Znox immediately, a flunky cries out, "Leader, the pain."
Mm-hmm.
Another crew member says, "We're being attacked, but by what?" So now you know that this compassion wave is being directed at the creatures, not at their constructs.
Right.
Apparently, however they are perceiving this, the Znox, it's painful. These images that burn our consciousness, they're not natural. It's more than we can stand. These are all comments from Znox.
Right.
You have some narrative on the Earther pages. One here in particular, "They know not what they do, only that sympathy and mercy well up within them and leap forth." So that is kind of what the professor is either tapping or causing to issue forth from the inhabitants of Earth. We see it being focused and fired by Scott, and then we see the results on the Znox, which are less than positive for them.
Mm-hmm.
keeps going, escalating as far as the Xenox are concerned, until finally the leader of the – or, well, we don't know if it's the leader here, but one of the Xenox says, "No Xenox can survive such mental corrosion. I sense our will to conquer being eaten away, and without that, we are nothing." So it's almost like they have some sort of hive mind. It struck me that together there is some sort of cohesion, that without that cohesion of purpose, they can't effectively do something. So that very much made me think of some sort of hive mind, or some almost social insect kind of mentality,
right,
that we would see here on Earth. Mm-hmm. To the extent that the planet turns and leaves Earth.
Yep, flees.
The X-Men stop what they're doing. Scott collapses. Alex collapses. We see the humans kind of acting interestingly, like something has happened mm-hmm. with them, to them, but they're not really sure what it is. It's not bad, but all of them have almost like you would think like some sort of deja vu kind of look, or some memory that they had forgotten that came to them.
Right.
They were looking for something, a revelatory almost kind of look, it seems to me. And the professor says, "Thank you and God bless." He passes out. Lorna kind of freaks out because she wasn't expecting him to pass out.
Hey, I lost you there for a good second or two.
Did you? Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. And when you came back, you were garbled. I can hear you now clearly. But from when you were talking about Scott and Alex passing out, you were gone.
Okay. I'll make a note here and look for that and see what it sounds like.
Try it again from Scott and Alex.
Okay.
Pass out.
We see on the scout ship that after the planet has left, Xavier apparently has ceased transmitting, that it's taken a toll on both Scott and Alex because they both seem to be wobbling, perhaps passing out, certainly drained by whatever they just went through. Well, actually, Scott says too much strain, blacking out.
Mm-hmm.
So we assume that that's what happened to him and Alex. The next panel is a collage of Earthers, all of them having this look like they just have remembered something or realized something or figured something out, something like that. Professor Xavier in the foreground, they're all panels scattered around him. Professor Xavier says, "Go and God bless."
Which I and found then, interesting. I think it's worth noting. It's like, wow, really? Okay.
Oh yeah, yeah. He then passes out, kind of freaking Lorna out. I guess, you know, she's kind of thinking, well, he's so strong enough to do this, you know, and then all of a sudden here he is just passing out. And he just passes out and, like, falls out of his wheelchair.
Well, I was going to say, passing out is one thing, but, you know, as a guy who, you know, basically lives his life in a wheelchair, I can say that passing out and then falling out of your chair, that's a huge thing for people around you.
Okay. All right.
So it's like, you know, ooh, he passed out. Oh, look, his head's on his shoulder. Oh, my God. He fell forward out of his wheelchair onto the floor and slammed his head.
Yeah, he did a header.
Yeah. So, you know, that's a big thing. So I can see why Lorna was like, Professor Xavier, you know.
The last couple panels are the away team, basically, not in Star Trek parlance, but just X-Men.
And luckily, no one is wearing red.
Right? No, not full red.
I was going to say
not full red,
yeah.
Aspect, but yeah. And Jean Grey has red hair.
But she's okay.
They're leaving the ship, and the one panel, I guess, is meant to show the scout ship as they're.
I'm guessing that
going away or something. You see something in the distance smoking.
Yeah, it blew up. What is it? I thought it said. Oh, no. The Xenox, they've deliberately exploded their vessel.
Yeah, so they fly off. You would think they fly off, leaving the ship in their rear, but here you see it out the side.
Yeah.
Like they've circled around somehow.
Maybe they did. Maybe they wanted to get a look at to make sure, you know, it was gone and there were no survivors or anyone that they needed to take care of.
I know what it is. They're going to Death Valley.
That has to be what it is.
They're not going straight home.
No.
They're going to New York by way of Death Valley.
Yeah, because that's the
from the magnetic.
The magnetic
pole.
Because that's the shortest distance between two points.
Two X points.
Yes.
Right. With next, the Hulk.
Now, see, I saw that, and I have seen and read, like, Wolverine and Hulk, you know, like adventures, like fights. And so when I read that, I was like, Hulk's a pretty, you know, badass kind of guy, especially back then. So what could he, you know, what havoc could – havoc – what problems could he, you know, place upon the X-Men? And how are they, some of the most powerful mutants, honestly, going to deal with it?
Right, right. Okay, a couple things here that I dug out. Apparently, if you have been reading the X-Men up to this point, Havoc and Polaris show up as full members kind of out of nowhere.
Really?
So we didn't miss that yet. It's not really explained. It just happens in this issue.
That's okay.
So somewhere between this issue and the previous three or four issues, which was the last time Havoc and Polaris were there, now they're full members. So
that's why they get their own, you know, costumes, right?
Exactly. That's exactly right.
All right.
And another thing, let's see, that comes to mind, or not mine, but the couple more things that I dug up. One is in the panel here where the planet turns and speeds off out of the solar system.
Yes.
You see emanating from Earth that compassion beam,
yep,
or whatever you want to call,
yep,
it. Here you don't know, but in later X-Men, that beam is used to explain something else, because for a period of time after the planet moved, the beam kept going.
Oh, because it would have been sent out.
Exactly. It would have still been transmitting,
yep,
but it would not have been bouncing off the planet.
Right.
It would have just kept going.
Oh, so – and they actually had continuity?
They used that,
oh,
later on. Actually, they used that in a very important, long-standing change kind of way.
That's cool. I like that.
On down the road. And what else did I see here? Oh, yes. On the letters page. One of the letters is been sent in from a gentleman named Doug Munch, M-O-E-N-C-H.
Letters page.
Ultimately, he turns out to write for Marvel. He's a he becomes in the mid to late 70s and early 80s a highly touted Marvel writer, as a matter of fact, and he's still writing today.
Oh, okay. So here's my non-comic ignorance. What's a letters page?
It's the page back in the back mutant mailbox. Where people used to write in and talk about previous issues. That was the way of communicating.
Oh, okay.
So you would write to your favorite comic book.
Okay. All right.
And over the years, in all of the different Marvel books, a lot of people that ultimately ended up being a creator, either a writer or an artist, oddly enough, popped up on a letters page somewhere, having been fan enough to have written in.
Right. Okay.
And had their letters published. Now, not all letters were legitimate.
Right. Well, yeah.
Some of them are created by staff. So I mean. But every now and then, you know, you'll come across a name, and that name turns out, because at this point, Doug Munch was not anybody. So why they would have faked the name of some, you know, I mean,
right,
there's just no way that they could have done that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it, you know, it's, oh, this guy who Doug Munch, yeah, you said this, and then it's like,
years later, Doug Munch. He works for us.
Oh yeah, hey yeah.
Really? So yeah, okay, it's cool.
Yeah, I can. I don't know how long it would be until you really found out on your own, but I mean, I can tell you about that energy beam if you want to know.
We can do it later.
Okay, it's quite a ways down the road.
Well, when we get to it, I think it'll be better.
So, okay, but yeah, that comes up having been used. Yeah, and now
let's not spoil a 40-year-old secret.
Now they would call it a retcon. I don't know what they called it when they used it.
Okay.
So. But yeah, they use that to explain something that becomes a fixture of the X-Men mythos, I guess you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And a pretty important piece too, not just something, but yeah, it's a pretty important piece. So yeah, that was kind of cool to find out, cuz I always wondered how what occurred.
Right.
And apparently I missed that reference back to this issue, mm-hmm. or just blew past it or whatever at the time.
So. Right.
All right, so thumbs up or thumbs down for this one?
You know what? X-Men for me is like pizza. Bad pizza is still good pizza. And bad X-Men is still good X-Men to me. I love the X-Men. The team has been one of the most endearing for me. Anytime I get the chance to find out more of the history and more of the things that happened before I started reading them and then stopped and started is always a good thing. So thumbs up two for me and pinkies too.
Cool beans. I would have to agree with that. They are what really got me hooked into comic books back in the middle to late 80s. All the way up through to now.
You said middle. I was thinking ages.
Every time, every month when I pick up all my books or when I get them through the mail, either some of the first ones I read are X-Men because I want to read them, or some of the last books I read are X-Men because I want to save them.
Yeah, exactly.
It depends on what mood I'm in, whether they're top of stack or bottom of stack. So,
all right. So here's something interesting. I'm going to give the listeners a little insight into my early childhood and your later childhood.
Okay, that was like what, yesterday?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
See, it doesn't hurt me like it does you.
So yeah. So what happened this weekend, Levi?
One of the things that I remember when I was a kid was, of course, that you were really into comic books. I remember that about you. But one of the things that I remember is Mom and Dad would go grocery shopping, and it would be about the time that a new comic would be coming out, and it would be an X-Men or something else. And you would, because you saw the cover in the previous issue that you had, you would have to go into great detail about what the cover looked like because you wanted them to go and look at the little spinny rack. You remember the little spinny racks?
Oh, of course.
So you would ask them to go and look at the spinny rack and look for this comic, and you would go into detail about the cover so that they would know exactly what to look for so they didn't buy the wrong thing, so that they would bring it back.
Okay. You got me. I don't quite remember doing that, but that certainly sounds like something that I would do.
It does, because it happens. So.
Okay. Cool. So there we go. And I believe most of their shopping was probably done at a Kroger.
Yep, that's exactly. Yep.
And Kroger had a magazine rack, but the comics were on a wire spinner rack.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. They had the two shelves of magazines and everything, but then the comics were separate, and they were in the little spinny rack.
Yeah. And you could look, and you might see two, three, 4 months of one book mm-hmm. as you went through it, and then maybe only the most recent of another book.
Yep, if they had it come in, yeah.
Yeah, there didn't necessarily seem to be a rhyme or reason
nope.
That I could figure out as to what was there and, more importantly, what wasn't there.
Right.
Yeah. That'd be kind of cool. You can still buy those spinner racks, but they are dang expensive.
Eh.
That'd almost be something cool to have around.
It would. It like in your living room?
Yeah.
Like put like your favorites or just, you know, like a genre or heck, what would be really cool is like just a team.
Okay. I would think that like right now, probably 90% of my monthly books I get mail order.
Mm-hmm.
So just open the box, get them, and just stick them in the rack until I read them.
Yep.
So that they're there, you know, somewhere in the spinner rack. Yeah. But yeah, oh man, those things are expensive. Because I have looked to see if it would be worth, if it's that cool. And so far it's not been that cool yet.
Right, exactly.
Alrighty, let's see.
So we rated the book. We both gave it a thumbs up.
Oh yeah, that book out of the ones we've covered so far here in season two, that's probably the strongest thumbs up for both of us of any of the books we've done so far. I would think.
Hands down, the thumbs up. Yes.
So
yeah,
hands down, thumbs up.
Yeah, That's the what. Never mind.
All right, guys, here, let's see. Next time out, for those of you that want to read ahead, we've got lined up Amazing Spider-Man issue 82 and Avengers, another one of my favorites, issue 74.
All right.
So that's what we'll do. And actually, next time it looks like we move into a new month in 1970 also.
Ooh, are we going to March?
Is that what it is? We've been in February?
Yeah, we've been in February.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to look and see here. So those are the first couple alphabetically, of course, because it's a little too difficult to find out precisely when these books came out. I don't think anybody has records like that, but
that would take a lot of research and probably you'd have to go to like Marvel headquarters.
Yeah, I don't know that anybody really online has been able to keep up with it that mm-hmm. much to know week by week, but at least we do know the months, and like we said at the beginning of the season two alphabetically within the month, so
and that's just the how first we do.
Yes, first two issues of March 1970. So
we're moving into March.
Ooh, we're all the way in March.
Seems like only yesterday we were in February.
It was earlier this weekend. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know what I mean. All right. So, guys, again. I'm going to challenge you. All right, listeners. Here is where we do the mystery quote. Okay, and the mystery quote. Last season, I drew the quote from any comic book. This season, I thought about it. Didn't make sense. Okay, it should be Marvel related because, well, this is a Marvel show. Okay. Last episode, I threw out the challenge of the mystery quote. Now, again, no one has responded or been able to figure it out. That's fine. This episode, I'm going to carry it forward. We're going to do the same quote. And I challenge you again, find out who said it and in what comic. Okay, that's it. It doesn't have to be the specific comic. It just has to be the comic line. Was it a Spider-Man? Was it an X-Men? Was it, you know, you get the idea. So, here's the mystery quote. But, what else can I expect to see after the end of the world? And all I want is who said it and what line it's from, what comic line it's from. That's it.
And if you guys will go back and listen to episode 2, I gave a pretty solid hint.
You did.
As to who this character was.
You did.
So, might not help you necessarily figure out what book, but a solid hint as to the character that said it.
Exactly. So again, I take my glove off and I throw it on the ground.
Oh man. Monty Python scenes are running through my head, but I can't say any of them. They're not those. They're others.
Right.
So. All right, now for you guys to send us the whatabouts and whereabouts of the quote or a word of the day, you can do so at the Marvel Bronze Age fan page on Facebook and or Google Plus. You can send it Gmail, which email to me is now snail mail, and the old letter writing just doesn't exist anymore.
They used to do what?
So yeah, well, the comic books are yeah. The Marvel Bronze Age, all one word, at gmail.com for the new electronic snail mail. And the website is bigtimenoise.com/Marvel Bronze Age, and you can leave comments there attached to whichever episode you want to leave a comment on, because the episodes go up there too. iTunes reviews. You can leave us an iTunes review.
We also have a Twitter.
We do have a Twitter. I'm sorry. It is The Marvel Bronze Age on Twitter. And I don't know. I haven't got notification that the show has been accepted, shown up on Stitcher yet, but it will be. For those of you that want to stream on the mobile devices, we will also be available on Stitcher, but I don't know 100% that we are right now today, or today whenever you listen to this one. So, but we will be.
All right.
So that'll be all the ways to get in touch with us, all the ways to listen to us, and there are many more ways to enjoy your Marvel comics. So have at it, guys. And I believe, Levi, are we good?
Let me think. Yes, we're good.
Then we will see you guys next time, episode 4, when we talk about some Spider-Man and some Avengers.
Exactly.
We'll catch you guys then.
Good night, everybody.
The Marvel Bronze Age podcast is a Teal production, and as such is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Non-Derivatives 3.0 Unported license. The song Super Freaks is provided and performed by the Hammerheads.